In his lifetime of 20 years, Burl had never wondered what his grandfather had thought about his surroundings. The grandfather had suffered an untimely, unpleasant end.
Which Burl remembered vaguely as a fading succession of screams as he was carried away at his mother's top speed. Burl had rarely thought of the old man since.
Surely he had never wondered what his great-grandfather thought, and there certainly never entered his head such a hypothetical question as what his many times great-grandfather, say, of the year 1920, would have thought of Burl's world.
Burl was a slender young man wearing a single garment twisted about his waist, made from the wing fabric of a great moth his tribesmen had slain as it emerged from its cocoon.
Burl would have been a curious sight to a 20th century man.
His skin was pink, like a child's, and sported little hair. Even that atop his head was soft and downy. His chest was larger than his forefathers, and his ears were capable of independent movement to catch threatening sounds from any direction. The pupils of his large blue eyes could dilate to extreme size, allowing him to see in almost complete darkness.
He was the result of 30,000 years of human adaptation to changes begun in the latter half of the 20th century. Then civilization had been high and apparently secure. Mankind had reached permanent accord, and machinery performed all labor. Men needed only supervise its operation. Everyone was well-fed and well-educated, and it seemed that until the end of time, Earth would be home to a community of comfortable human beings, pursuing their studies and diversions, illusions and truths. Peace, privacy, and freedom were universal. But just when men were congratulating themselves on this new golden age, fissures opened slowly in the Earth's crust and carbon dioxide began pouring out into the atmosphere. Scientists noted the Earth's increased fertility, but discounted it as the effect of carbon dioxide released by man's burning of fossil fuels. By the middle of the 21st century, it was generally recognized that a new carboniferous period was beginning, when Earth's atmosphere would be thick and humid, unbreathable by man, when giant grasses and ferns would form the only vegetation. As the 21st century closed, the human race began reverting to savagery. The lowlands were unbearable, the air depressing and enervating. Life there became a sickly, fever-ridden existence. All mankind desired the highlands, and men forgot their two centuries of peace. They fought destructively, each for a bit of land where he might live and breathe. Then men died of sheer inanition at 1,000 feet. The plateaus and mountaintops were crowded with folks struggling for footholds and food beyond the invisible menace that crept up and up. There was but one solution. The human body would have to inure itself to the poison or face extinction. It finally developed a toleration for the gas that had wiped out entire races and nations, but at a terrible cost. Lungs increased in size to secure the oxygen of life, but the poison, inhaled at every breath, left the few survivors sickly and perpetually weary. Their minds lacked energy to cope with new problems or communicate knowledge.
So, after 30,000 years, Burl was ignorant of fire, metals, or the uses of stone and wood. A single garment covered him. His language was a meager group of a few hundred labial sounds, conveying no abstractions and few concrete things.
Of the animal world above water, insects alone endured the change. They multiplied and enlarged in the thickened air. The tiniest butterflies of former days grew until their gaily colored wings measured in terms of feet, while the larger emperor moths extended their purple sails to a breadth of yards upon yards.
3 days before, Burl had crouched behind a bulky, shapeless fungus, watching a furious duel between two huge horned beetles.
Their jaws gaping wide clicked and clashed on each other's armor. Their legs clashed like cymbals as their polished surfaces ground and struck each other.
Burl had watched until a gaping orifice appeared in the armor of the smaller beetle. It uttered a shrill cry, or seemed to.
The noise was actually the tearing of the horny stuff beneath the jaws of its victorious adversary. The wounded beetle's struggles weakened, At last, it collapsed, and the conqueror placidly began to eat the conquered alive.
After the meal was finished, Burl approached the scene with caution. He hastily seized the detached, sharp-pointed snout of the victim and fled. Later, he inspected his find curiously. The victim had been a minotaur beetle with a sharp, pointed horn like that of a rhinoceros. Burl examined the sharp, dagger-like instrument. He pricked out his finger on the point and flung it aside as he crept to the hiding place of his tribe.
Burl's people herded together in a leaderless group, coming to the same hiding place to share the finds of the lucky and gather comfort in numbers. They numbered only 20, 4 men, 6 women, the rest adolescents and children. They had no weapons. They bashed stones against the limbs of insects they found partly devoured, cracking them open for what scraps of sweetmeat remained inside, but sought safety from enemies solely in flight and hiding.
The next morning, Burl found the horn where he had thrown it, sticking in the flabby side of a toadstool. He retrieved it, and gradually, far back in his mind, an idea began to form. His imagination began to work fitfully. He visualized himself stabbing food as the larger beetle had stabbed the former owner of the weapon he now possessed. He thought, where was their food? Food that lived, that would not fight back. Presently, he rose and made his way toward the tiny river.
150 yards downstream, an outcropping of rock made a steep descent to the river, from which shelf fungi stretched out. Dark red and orange above, light yellow below, they formed a series of platforms above the smoothly flowing stream.
Burl moved cautiously towards them. En route, he saw one of the edible mushrooms that formed most of his diet, and paused to break from the flabby flesh an amount that would feed him for many days.
Often, his people would find a store of food, carry it to their hiding place, then gorge themselves for days, eating, sleeping, until all was gone.
Burl was tempted to abandon his plan. He would give Saya of this food, and they would eat together. Saya was the maiden who roused unusual emotions in Burl when she was near. Strange impulses to touch and caress her. He did not understand. He went on, after hesitating. If he brought her food, Saya would be pleased. But if he brought her of the things that swam in the stream, she would be more pleased.
Degraded as his tribe had become, Burl was yet a little more intelligent. He was an atavism, a throwback to ancestors who had cultivated the earth and subjugated its animals. He had a vague remnant of pride, unformed, but potent.
He reached the rocky outcropping and lay prostrate, staring into the water's shallow depths. A huge crayfish, as long as Burl, leisurely crossed his vision.
Small fishes and even huge newts fled before the voracious creature. Eventually, the tide of underwater life resumed its activity. The wriggling dragonfly grubs reappeared. Little flecks of silver swam into view, a school of tiny fish. A larger fish appeared, moving slowly.
Burl's eyes glistened, his mouth watered. He reached down with his long weapon, barely touched the water. Disappointment filled him, yet the nearness and apparent practicability of his scheme spurred him on. He considered the situation. The shell fungi were below him. He rose and moved to a point just above them, then thrust his spear down.
They resisted its point.
Burl tested them tentatively with his foot, then dared to trust his weight to them.
They held firmly.
He clambered onto them and lay flat, again peering over the edge.
The large fish, as long as Burl's arm, swam slowly to and fro below.
Burl had seen the former owner of his spear strive to thrust it into an opponent. So when the fish swam by, he thrust it sharply downward. Burl's astonishment, the spear seemed to bend where it entered the water and missed its mark by inches. He tried again and again. He grew angry with the fish. Repeated strokes had left it untouched, and it was insultingly unwary, not even trying to flee. Finally, the fish stopped directly beneath his eyes. Burl thrust straight down with all his strength. This time, the spear entering vertically did not seem to bend. Its point penetrated the scales of the swimmer below, transfixing that lazy fish completely.
An uproar began, the fish struggling to escape,
and Burl trying to draw it up to his perch. Excited, he failed to notice an ominous approaching ripple on the water. Then there was a tremor in Burl's support. It gave way. Falling into the stream with a mighty splash, Burl submerged, eyes wide open, facing death. As he sank, he saw waving before him the gaping claws of the huge crayfish, large enough to sever a limb with one stroke of their jagged jaws. Burl was sure he would die, for he could not swim. The only question was whether he would drown or be devoured first.
But the section of the shelf fungus that had collapsed beneath him was lighter than water. It rapidly surfaced.
With Burl still on top.
The crayfish, deprived of its prey, wandered off.
He finally recovered his self-possession and looked for his spear. It was floating in the water, still transfixing the fish whose capture had endangered Burl's life. The fish now floated lifelessly, belly upward. Burl forgot his predicament upon seeing his prey just out of reach. He gazed at it, mouth watering, while his cranky craft went downstream, spinning slowly in the current. He hastened to the edge of the raft. It tilted and nearly flung him overboard. Experimenting, Burl soon found that it remained stable if he lay flat across it. He wriggled into position and waited until the slow revolution of his vessel brought the spear shaft near. He stretched his fingers and arm and grasped it. A moment later, he was tearing strips of flesh from the fish and cramming the oily mess into his mouth with gusto. He had lost his edible mushroom, yet Burl ate contentedly of what he possessed. He happily visualized the delight with which Saya would receive a gift of part of the fish he had caught. Burl suddenly realized he was being carried farther and farther from Saya. Stricken with dumb sorrow, he lifted his head and looked longingly at the riverbanks. Presently, Burl ate again of the oily fish. The taste pleased him, a rare break from his diet of insipid mushrooms. He stuffed himself, though the size of his prey left most uneaten. He next stripped a sinew from the garment about his middle and hung the fish from his neck with it. That left him both hands free.
Time passed and sunset grew near.
Homesick, he lay on his floating atom all night. At last, the mushroom raft struck gently and remained grounded on a shallow in the stream. At daybreak, Burl gazed keenly about.
He was 20 yards from shore, and the greenish scum surrounded his now disintegrating vessel. The river had widened until the other bank was barely visible through the haze above the surface, but the nearer shore seemed firm and no more dangerous than the territory his tribe inhabited.
He found himself in another toadstool forest and finally paused. He recognized the type of fungus growths around him and began eating voraciously. In Burl, the sight of food always produced hunger, nature's compensation for his lack of an instinct to store food. Burl's heart was small within him. He was far from Saya and his tribe.
Just 40 miles separated them.
But Burl did not think of distances. He had come down the river. He was alone in a land he had never known or seen.
Food was plentiful. The mushrooms surrounding him were edible, a supply of sustenance Burl's whole tribe could not have eaten in many days.
But that very fact made him think of Saya. He suddenly remembered the large, oily fish he had caught for her, still hanging down his neck from the sinew about his neck. He took it and fingered it all over, getting his hands and himself thoroughly greasy in the process. But he could eat no more. The thought of Saya's pleasure at the sight of it gave him renewed determination.
Overconfidence now possessed Burl.
He walked less cautiously, more boldly. The fact that he had struck something and destroyed it lent him foolhardy courage. He climbed to the top of a red clay cliff, 100 feet high.
From a point halfway up the cliff, the inch-thick cable of a spider's web stretched down to an anchorage on the ground. The geometrical pattern of the web glistened evilly. Somewhere among the cliffside fungi, the huge creature waited until some unfortunate prey would struggle helplessly in its monster snare. The spider waited, motionless, implacably patient, invincibly certain of prey, utterly merciless to its victims.
Burl strutted at the cliff's edge,
A silly little pink-skinned creature with an oily fish slung about his neck, a draggled fragment of moth's wing about his middle, and a beetle's nose in his hand.
He looked scornfully down on the whitely shining trap. He had struck mushrooms, and they had fallen before him. He feared nothing. He knew the spider would not leave its web to attack. Using his spear, he shoved a chunk of fungus growing at his feet down the cliffside into the colossal web.
The black bulk of a hidden spider swung out to investigate.
Burl kept pace with it, knocking more lumps of shelf fungus loose and laughing as they narrowly missed the confused black and silver creature. Then,
the trap door clicked faintly and Burl whirled. His laughter became a scream. Approaching with incredible speed, the monster tarantula opened its dripping jaws, mandibles gaping wide, poison fangs unsheathed. The creature was 30 paces away, 20, 10. It leaped into the air, all eight legs extended to seize.
Still screaming, Burl thrust out his arms to ward off the impact. In his terror, his grasp on his spear became agonized. The spear point shot out and the tarantula fell on it.
Nearly a quarter of the spear entered the body of the ferocious thing. Transfixed on the spear, the monster writhed nightmarishly, still struggling to reach Burl,
who himself was transfixed with horror.
Mandibles clashed. Awful sounds came from the beast. One of the attenuated, hairy legs rasped across Burl's forearm.
He instinctively stepped backwards, off the edge of the cliff.
Down through space, eyes glassy with panic, the two creatures, man and skewered tarantula, fell together. With a strangely elastic crash and crackling, they hit the web below.
Burl could be no more fearsome. Struggling madly in the gummy coils of an immense web, ever binding him more tightly, with the wounded creature still striving to reach him with poison fangs, Burl had reached the limit of panic. He fought madly to break the coils about him. His arms and breasts were greasy from the oily fish. The sticky web did not adhere to them, but his legs and body were inextricably fastened by the elastic thread spread for just such prey as he. He paused, exhausted. Then he saw, 5 yards away, a silvery and black monster waiting patiently for him to tire.
It judged the moment propitious. The tarantula and man were one in its eyes, one struggling thing that had fallen opportunely into its snare. They moved, but feebly now. The spider advanced, delicately, swinging its huge bulk nimbly along the web, playing out a cable after it, coming inexorably closer.
Burl's arms were free because of the greasy coating they had received. He waved them wildly, shrieking at the approaching pitiless monster.
It paused.
Burl, the cables of the web give slightly
as the spider approached to sting and suck the sweet juices from its prey.
Burl froze in an ecstasy of terror, waiting for poisoned fangs to be thrust into him. He knew the process, having seen the leisurely way giant spiders delicately stung their prey, then withdrew to wait patiently for the venom to take effect.
The bloated, evil creature moved meditatively about the shining sheet of silk it had cast over Burl and the giant tarantula. Now, only the tarantula moved feebly. Its body, outlined by a bulge in the concealing shroud, throbbed faintly as it struggled with the spear in its vitals. The rounded protuberance offered an obvious target. The web spider moved quickly forward and stung. Galvanized into fresh torment by this new agony, the tarantula writhed in a very hell of pain. Its legs struck out purposely in horrible gestures of delirious suffering.
Burl screamed as one touched him and struggled himself. His arms and head were both free beneath the silken sheet because of the grease and oil coating them. Striving to escape his deadly neighbor, Burl clutched at the threads about him.
They did not break, but parted, and a tiny opening appeared. One of the tarantula's attenuated limbs touched him again.
With the strength of utter panic, he hauled himself away.
The opening enlarged.
Burl's head emerged into open air and stared down 20 feet on an open space carpeted with spiky shards of his captor's former victims. Burl's head, breast, and arms were free, but his lower body was held firm by a gummy snare far more tenacious than any bird lime ever manufactured by man. He hung a moment in his tiny window, despairing. He saw, at a little distance,
the monster spider waiting patiently for its poison to take effect and the struggling of its prey to cease. and the tarantula was weakening, only shuddering now.
Burl withdrew his head and thrust desperately at the sticky stuff about his legs and loin. The oil in his hands kept it from clinging to them, and it gave away. In a flash of inspiration, Burl understood. He reached over his shoulder and grasped the greasy fish, tore it in a dozen places, and smeared himself with the now rancid exudation, pushing the sticky thread from his limbs and oiling the surface from which he had thrust it. He felt the web tremble.
To the spider, its poison seemed to have failed. Another sting seemed necessary. It would again inject its deadly venom where the disturbance was manifest, into Burl.
He gasped and drew himself toward the window. It felt as if he was pulling his legs from his body. His head emerged, his shoulders. Half his body was outside the hole. He shot through the opening and fell sprawling to the earth below, crashing onto the shrunken shell of a flying beetle which had fallen into the snare and had not escaped. Burl rolled over and over, then sat up. Burl ran a few hundred yards and stopped. It behooved him to move carefully. Even the most familiar territory was full of unexpected dangers. Unknown lands such as these were doubly perilous. Burl, too, found difficulty in moving. The glutinous stuff from the spider's snare still stuck to his feet, picking up small objects as he went. Old ant-gnawed fragments of insect armor pricked him even through his toughened soles. He removed them, took a dozen steps, and had to stop again.
Burl's brain had been uncommonly stimulated lately. It had gotten him into at least one predicament due to his invention of a spear, but extricated him from another. Reason had led him to oil his body to escape the spider's snare.
Cautiously, Burl looked about him. He seemed safe. Then deliberately, he sat down to think.
Never in his life had he done such a thing. His tribesmen were not given to meditation, but a powerful idea had struck Burl, an abstract idea.
When he was in difficulties, something within him seemed to suggest a solution. Would it do so now? He puzzled over the problem. Sharp pebbles, remnants of insect armor, and other things hurt his feet when he walked. They always had, but never had his feet been sticky so that the irritation continued with him more than one step. He gazed at his foot and awaited inspiration. Meanwhile, he slowly removed the sharp-pointed fragments one by one. Partly coated with a half-liquid gum from his feet, they clung to his finger, except where the oil was thick.
Burl's reasoning before had been simple and of primary order. Where oil covered him, the web did not. Therefore, he would coat the rest of himself with oil. But to apply knowledge gained in one predicament to another difficulty was something he had never done. Imminent peril had stirred Burl to invention. That was extraordinary enough. But reasoning in cold blood, as he did now, that
oil on his feet would nullify the glue there and enable him to walk in comfort.
That was as much a triumph of intellect as any masterpiece of art in the ages before.
He oiled his feet.
It was an infinitesimal problem, but Burl's struggles with the mental process of reasoning were real. He was teaching himself how to think. And with touching faith in his new pastime, Burl sat down again and knitted his brows. His questions were easily answered.
He was naked. He would fashion garments. He was weaponless. He would find a spear. He was hungry, he would seek food. He was far from Saya and his tribe. He would go to them.
Puerile reasoning, of course, but valuable, because it was conscious reasoning, conscious appeal to his mind for guidance, deliberate mental progression from desire to resolution. Even in the high civilization of ages before, few men had really used their brains. The great majority had depended on machines and leaders to think for them. Burl, however, was developing the habit of thinking, a leadership quality, and an invaluable asset to his little tribe.
He stood again and faced upstream. Here and there, Burl saw various flies, some no longer than his thumb, others the size of his whole hand.
They fed on juices dripping from maggot-infested mushrooms when filth more to their liking was unavailable. Far away, a shrill roaring sounded faintly. It was like multitudinous clickings blended into a single sound, but it was so distant that it did not gain Burl's attention. He had all the strictly localized vision of a child. What was near was important. What was distant could be ignored. Had Burl listened, he would have realized that army ants were abroad in countless millions, deploying themselves in a broad array and wreaking greater destruction than so many locusts. Burl did not notice the sound, however. Preoccupied,
he moved forward, briskly though cautiously, searching for garments, food, and weapons. He confidently expected to find them all shortly. Surely enough, he found a thicket of edible fungi just half a mile beyond the spot where he had sat down to think. Burl tugged at one end and broke off a piece. Nibbling as he went, he entered a broad plain over a mile across, broken into odd little hillocks by gradually ripening and suddenly developing mushrooms with which he was unfamiliar, their rounded blood-red protuberances forced aside the earth as they grew.
Behind, a high, shrill roaring grew slightly louder,
but remained too far away to impress Burl.
The army ants were wreaking havoc in the distance. By millions, they were foraging the country, climbing every eminence, descending every depression, antennae waving restlessly, mandibles extended threateningly. The ground was black with them, each 10 inches long. A single such creature would be formidable to an unarmed, naked man like Burl, whose wisest move would be flight. But in numbers, they represented a menace from which escape seemed impossible. They advanced steadily and rapidly amid shrill stridulations and multitudinous clickings.
Meanwhile, Burl was inspecting the rent and scraped remains of a great beetle's shiny casing lying on the ground. A greater beetle had met it first and slain it. The best he could find was a fiercely toothed hind leg. He picked it up and went on, swinging the toothed limb in his hand. Accustomed to using stones to crush the juicy legs of the giant crickets his tribe sometimes scavenged, he formed a half-defined idea of a club. The sharp teeth of the thing in his hand made him realize that a sidewise blow was better than a spear-like thrust.
The sound behind had become a distant whispering, high-pitched and nearer. The army ants swept over a mushroom forest, and a yellow branching tree-like growth swarmed with black creatures devouring the substance to which they clung.
A great blue-bottle fly, shining with metallic luster, reposed in an ecstasy of feasting, sipping through its long proboscis the dark-colored liquid that dripped slowly from a mushroom. Burl drew near and struck. The fly collapsed into a writhing heap. Burl stood over it, pondering.
A quarter mile to the left of Burl's line of march, and a mile behind the spot where he stood over the dead fly, was an acre-wide stretch where giant, rank cabbages had so far resisted the encroachments of the ever-present mushrooms. The pale, cross-shaped cabbage flowers fed many bees, while the leaves fed numberless grubs, worms, and loud-voiced crickets, which crouched about on the ground, munching busily at the succulent green stuff. The army ants swept into the green area, ceaselessly devouring all they encountered. A terrific din arose. The crickets hurtled away in a rocket-like flight, a dark cloud of wildly beating wings. They shot aimlessly in any direction. Half fell into the black tide of devouring insects. It was seized instantly. They uttered terrible cries as they were torn to bits. Horrible, inhuman screams reached Burl's ears.
Individual cries of such agony were too commonplace to attract Burl's attention, but the chorus of tormented creatures made him look up. This was no minor horror, but wholesale slaughter. He peered anxiously toward the sound. From where he stood, Burl could see three great grubs in lazy contentment eating ceaselessly the cabbages on which they rested.
Suddenly, first one and then another began to jerk spasmodically. About each, a rim of black appeared. Tiny black motes milled over the cabbages' green surfaces. The grubs and cabbages became black. Horrible contortions of the writhing grubs bespoke their agonies. Then a black wave appeared at the further edge of the stretch of sickly yellow fungus, a glistening, living wave, moving forward rapidly with the roar of clickings and a persistent overtone of shrill stridulation.
The hair rose on Burl's head. He knew all too well the meaning of that tide of shining bodies. With a gasp of terror, intellectual preoccupations forgotten, he turned and fled in ultimate panic.
And the tide came inexorably on.